calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast. Welcome to pleased to have you with our program today. The Bush administration, strange stuff going on, just absolutely strange stuff going on. New privatization of Social Security, a new study. This, of course, you know, George Bush has stopped his traveling around the country trying to flog this thing, because the more times he would show up someplace and say, oh, privatize Social Security, yeah, that's what we need to do, the more often he did that, the more often he was dropping in the polls. But the bottom line is that if he is successful in turning Social Security into a massive slush fund for multinational corporations and huge banks in New York, if he's successful in doing that, according to this new study titled Social Security, the Civil Rights Program for All Americans from the Leadership Council for Civil Rights, it will drive millions of Americans into poverty. Keep in mind, Social Security is probably the most effective anti-poverty program we've ever had. Probably one of the reasons why conservatives have been fighting it ever since it was first put into law in the 1930s. Because if you have a lot of very poor people, then you've got a cheap labor force and you've got people who have really basically no political rights. I mean, that's the bottom line. In 1936, July 27, 1936, when Franklin Roosevelt accepted his nomination for the second term from his party as the Democratic nominee for President of the United States, he quoted an old English judge. He said, yeah, I forget the judge's name now. He said, an old English judge once said, a necessitous man is not a free man. Now, in other words, somebody who's hungry is not free. Somebody whose basic needs are not met is not free. And Roosevelt felt that it was vital that we provide this social safety net to provide people with the freedom to then step off from that into the search for opportunity. But conservatives, Republicans in particular, have been trying to destroy Social Security since it was founded. They fought it tooth and nail when it was created. It has been part of their agenda forever. It was part of George W. Bush's agenda when he ran for Congress unsuccessfully and failed back in the 1970s. It's still part of their agenda. 48 million people are receiving Social Security benefits in the United States, and over a third of them are not retired people. They're people with disabilities, retirees, widows, children. People who, without Social Security, would be wiped out, absolutely wiped out. And this new study, you know, essentially tells us what we already knew. Bush's plan will further increase the gap between rich and poor of the United States. You know, when you add up, they say the official unemployment rate in the United States is around 5%. When you add in the number of people who are actually have given up looking for work, or the number of people who are unemployed and no longer receiving unemployment benefits to the official unemployment rate. We have an actual unemployment rate in this country of around 20%. It's huge. It's among the highest in the industrialized world, in part because of the insane trade policies that this administration has been following, in part because Alan Greenspan believes, and has been pretty upfront about saying, that he believes that part of his responsibility as chairman of the Fed is to create a certain level of what he calls worker insecurity, so that there won't be what he calls wage inflation. Now, it's okay if there's CEO wage inflation, but you can't have worker wage inflation. That would be a bad thing. So, it's a tragedy. Nick Terse and TomDispatch.com put together a fascinating collection of the people who have been destroyed by this administration. Again, looking at the larger picture of the Bush administration, not so much as government, as an administration in government, but really more as an institution or an organization that has a very specific agenda, that being the corporate agenda, that being the agenda of inherited wealth and corporate power. There are about 7,000 to 8,000 individuals who run the 1,000 largest corporations in America, who essentially are the rulers of this country and much of the rest of the industrialized world. And I don't mean that in some sort of conspiracy theory thing. I mean, it's just, this is just a simple reality. And they don't mingle among the average people. You don't find them sitting in first class on your commercial jets. They fly private aircraft. They live in a world apart, in castles and mansions and on yachts. And that, of course, is the constituency of the Bush administration. But when you look at the folks that they have destroyed, they have been, by and large, well, first of all, if you look at the people that they've been promoted, it's been, by and large, the people who have, number one, demonstrated great loyalty to the Bush administration. Great loyalty, Condi Rice. She presided over the greatest national security failure as national security advisor in the history of the United States. 56 specific warnings that bin Laden was going to attack inside the United States, that they were going to hijack airplanes, that they were looking at high-profile targets in Washington, D.C. and New York, that they were going to do it in the summer of 2000, summer or fall of 2001. All of these warnings, and Condi Rice, oblivious, or worse. I mean, you know, that's the debate that's going on. Tragically, not a serious investigation of that happening. But here is, she presided over the worst intelligence failure in the history of the United States, and so she's given a promotion to Secretary of State. Now, George Tenet, the head of the CIA, presiding over a terrible failure of intelligence or manipulation of intelligence, allowing it to happen, allowing Dick Cheney to come down and mess with his CIA, George Tenet, given the Medal of Freedom. Paul Bremer goes over to Iraq, and he screws things all up, so now we have this disaster that he's given the Medal of Freedom. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. If you screw up, Paul Wolfowitz, one of the architects of the war in Iraq, one of the major neocons, one of the guys whose idea it was to fire the Iraqi army, to privatize Iraq, to make unions illegal, to allow corporations to come in and do anything they want, to impose a flat tax, to create a conservative utopia in Iraq. And sure enough, it is a utopia. For a few rich folks and for the mullahs, or it may become one. But one of the principal guys responsible for this disaster, made president of the World Bank, John Bolton, who was down there banging on the windows in Florida, saying, "Stop the vote, stop the vote, stop the vote," rewarded for and his terrible failures. Every negotiation he was involved in going down in flames. Finally, the State Department had to pull him out of the negotiations with North Korea because he was screwing things up so badly. He gets promoted to a U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. John Roberts, who ruled in favor of the administration, saying you have no civil rights. You can be put in jail without access to an attorney, without access to a trial, without access to a jury, without being charged with crimes. Who had gone down to Florida and was one of those people with John Bolton banging on the windows saying, stop the vote, stop the vote, was advising Jeb Bush as a constitutional authority on how Jeb Bush could help his brother steal the election in Florida and do it legally, to the extent that it was done legally. Certainly there was a lot of extra legal affairs as well. And who coached the lawyers who argued in Bush v. Gore on he played the role of Rehnquist, for whom he had clerked. John Roberts promoted to Supreme Court Justice, Chief Justice. I mean, it's like this administration promotes those who are loyal to them, regardless of their competence. And then the people who are really and truly competent but don't have loyalty, don't follow the code of omerta, who aren't part of the family, they get trashed. And this list that Nick Terse put together, really remarkable. Richard Clark. Clark became disillusioned with the terrible job of fighting terrorism exhibited by George W. Bush, in other words, ignoring al-Qaeda. And he quit in January 2003. The Bush administration starts trashing him. Paul O'Neill, multimillionaire, top official under Presidents Nixon and Ford, chairman of Alcoa, served nearly 2 years as Secretary of Treasury under George W. Bush. And then he comes out and starts telling us, he says, from the very beginning there was a conviction that Saddam Hussein was a bad person and needed to go. He says, in other words, from the very beginning of the administration, he says, it was all about finding a way to do it. That was the tone of it. The president say, go find me a way to do this. He was fired December 6, 2002. Larry Lindsey, top economic advisor to Bush, He says to a newspaper, the war in Iraq, yeah, it's probably going to cost $200 billion. Boom, fired, December 2002. Anne Reich, career diplomat in the Foreign Service, colonel in the Army Reserves, resigned on the day the U.S. launched the Iraq War. In a letter to the resignation to Colin Powell, she says, I believe the administration's policies are making the world a more dangerous, not a safer place. I feel obligated morally and professionally to set out my deep and firm concerns and to resign from government service that I cannot defend or implement. Resigned March 19th, 2003. The bodies the Bush administration has left. It's 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends. 21 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. I only know one party, that's freedom. Well said. Welcome back to the program. Looking at some of the failures of the Bush administration. By the way, our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS. Give them a call. Tell them Tom Hartman said hi. Smalldog.com, also on the web. You can get the latest iPods, all things Macintosh, repair, help, and all things PC as well. So any kind of computer help that you may need, give them a call. Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MACS. We were just going through some of the folks who have left the Bush administration, and this is not by way of, you know, some whiny complaint or some, you know, oh, look at this, they did this, this is terrible. But really, the frame for this, the point that I want to make about this is that there have been some very, very good people who have given much of their lives to government service, who were part of the Bush administration for a long time or for some time, and who, in leaving, said some very important things. And it has not been reported in the press. It has been largely ignored, by and large. And I think it's really important that we remember who these folks are and what they had to say, because it's a symptom of a larger problem, which is this sickness in the body politic, which broadly, you know, you could refer to as the corruption within the Republican Party. But frankly, I'd say it goes beyond that. We see the same thing in the Democratic Party with the Democratic Leadership Council, the whole DLC thing. And, you know, Evan Bayh and Hillary Clinton and this whole bunch that are saying, oh, let's move the Democratic Party to the right. And they call it centrist, but it's really the right. It's really the corporate right. And you know, heaven forbid anybody should say, oh, gee, we're in favor of national health care. It's just, you know, 85% of Americans believe that, but politically you can't say that. Well, you can't say that if you want to get money from the health insurance industry or the pharmaceutical industry or the AMA. You know, so anyhow, I'm going off on another rant here. Let me get back to some of these folks who left the Bush administration and left messages for us that I think are important for us to hear. And once again, to give credit where credit's due, Nick Terse at TomDispatch.com put this thing together. It's called Casualties of the Bush Administration, the Fallen Legion. And, you know, well done to Nick. John Brady Kiesling, he was a career diplomat. This guy served four presidents over a 20-year span. He was the political counselor in the U.S. Embassy in Athens, Greece, when we invaded Iraq. He resigned on February 27, 2003. He wrote, and I quote, Until this administration, it had been possible to believe that by upholding the policies of my president, I was also upholding the interests of the American people and the world. I believe it no longer. Our current course will bring instability and danger, not security. This was 2.5 years ago this guy said this. John Brady Kiesling, career diplomat, served four presidents, both Republicans and Democrats. No political axe to grind. John Brown, another one. After 25 years in the Foreign Service, he served in London, Prague, Kiev, Krakow, Belgrade, served under Republicans and Democrats. When he resigned on the 10th of March in 2003, he wrote, and I quote, this is John Brown, one of a distinguished American diplomat. John Brown, quote, I cannot in good conscience support President Bush's war plans against Iraq. The president has failed to explain clearly why our brave men and women in uniform should be ready to sacrifice their lives in a war on Iraq at this time. He has failed to lay out the full ramifications of this war, including the extent of innocent civilian casualties. He has failed to specify the economic costs of the war for the ordinary Americans. He has failed to clarify how the war would help rid the world of terror. And he has failed to take international public opinion against the war into serious consideration. These are people who gave up careers, not just a job, not just a paycheck. They gave up careers, and they did it in the face of an administration that says, hey, if you cross us, we will destroy not only you and your life, we'll go after your wife. Rand Beers, the national the chief director for combating terrorism at the National Security Council. When he resigned, he was rather tight-lipped, but a former intelligence official noted, he resigned in March of 2003, former intelligence official noted, hardly a surprise. We have sacrificed a war on terror for a war with Iraq. I don't blame Randy at all. This just reflects the widespread thought that the war on terror is being set aside for the war with Iraq at the expense of our military and intelligence resources and the relationships with our allies. Rand Beers himself later said, the administration wasn't matching its deeds to its words in the war on terrorism. They're making us less secure, not more secure. As an insider, I saw that things weren't being done. The longer I sat and watched, the more I became concerned until I got up and walked out. And then we have Condi Rice this weekend trying to mix 9/11 and Iraq, you know, once again. I had to share that sound clip with you when we come back from the break. But it's just the perfidy, the willingness of this administration to lie to us in order to accomplish goals that are not the goals of America, that are not congruent with the desires of the majority of Americans, is shocking. 27 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Yes, indeed. 34 minutes past the hour, 34 and a half past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-THOM, our number. If you'd like to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartman.com and click Live Chat. Hang out with some of the finest minds on the whole entire Internet. And engage in some of the most fascinating conversation you'll find on the whole entire Internet. And occasionally a little strange, occasionally very thoughtful, occasionally very intellectual, occasionally totally wacky. But so, hey, everybody there. I got the screen right in front of me here as I'm on the air. Today, the new U.S. bankruptcy law, today, Monday, October 17, the new bankruptcy law went into effect. And agencies that offer debt counseling are essentially doubling their business under this new law because the new law requires that you get credit counseling. Now, who's funding the companies that are doing the credit counseling? Surprise, surprise. Credit counseling agencies, this from an article by Brent Hunsenberger in the Oregonian. Credit counseling agencies get most of their funding from grants and fees paid by creditors and fees charged to the consumers seeking advice, industry officials say. To help the agencies, 16 of the nation's largest credit card companies and lenders agreed to give $10 million through an industry lobbying group with an additional $20 million in grants possibly next year. Right. On Friday, Oregon, which typically gets 70 filings a day for bankruptcy, received 2,944. Now, this is an absolute sellout and betrayal of not just average Americans and working Americans, but of the American ideals. And here's why. The reason why we have bankruptcy laws in the United States are twofold. The first is that we have, for over 200 years in this country, we have wanted to encourage people to take risks. Henry Ford declared bankruptcy 7 times before he finally got it right. We have wanted to encourage people to take risks in order to build businesses that have helped build this country. Bankruptcy laws allow people to step out and say, you know, I'm going to take a chance. I'm going to move to a new city. I'm going to try a new job. I'm going to try a different profession. I'm going to drop out and go back to school and learn something new and hope I can find a place in the workplace. I'm going to start a business. Bankruptcy laws allowed people to take risk. Risk has always been an American ideal. What we are saying now with this new bankruptcy law is the only people who are allowed to take risks are people who are already living on the edge. In other words, their entire life is a risk. The only people who can declare Chapter 7 bankruptcy any longer are now totally indigent folks. And in fact, if you take a risk, you are risking not just a big chunk of, you know, not just, for example, your credit rating. You're risking everything. And you will have to be, you will be in debt. You could be in debt for the rest of your life. So number one, this bankruptcy law and the legislators who voted for it not only betrayed the foundational principles upon which this country was founded and which made this country great, they also betrayed many of the people in this country who are the least able, the least capable of defending themselves. And this is not some bleeding heart, let's help people with welfare kind of riff. The reality is that half of all bankruptcies in the United States are declared by middle-class working people, the majority of whom had health insurance, who got sick and got hit with health, a member of their family got sick, and because the health insurance has so many damn holes in it, and so many loopholes, and so many, oh, we didn't cover that, and so many gotchas in it, that they got wiped out by their medical bills. Half of all bankruptcies in the United States are the result of somebody getting sick. We should not tell somebody, if you get sick, for the rest of your life, your paycheck is going to be garnished. Number one. A third of all bankruptcies in the United States, are the result of death or divorce. Most of them, women, single women or women with children, usually, not always, but usually, where the husband, the breadwinner, the person or the person who had the highest income, you know, tragically in America, we don't have equity among genders in the United States in terms of pay. The husband or breadwinner leaves the family, divorces, heads off into the sunset, or dies. And you've got a mother with children or a child or a single woman who doesn't have the earnings power but may have the bills. They split the bills. They split the house. Well, good luck. So a third of bankruptcies in the United States were the result of divorce or death. Half of bankruptcies are the result of medical bills that wiped people out. In total, that's 5/6 of all bankruptcies. That's, you know, between 80 and 90%. Even the credit card industry itself will tell you that only between 1 and 7%, depending on how you define fraud, of bankruptcies are fraudulent bankruptcies or people abusing the system. And there were already laws against that. But that wasn't enough. And the Republicans in the House and Senate who pushed this thing through and the Democrats who went along with it, in my opinion, have sold us out. And today is the day it goes into effect. And America is discovering that, you know, the classic and historic ideals of this country, sorry, they don't count anymore. Interesting study here. Chemical found in cannabis. This, you'll recall on Friday, I told you the story about the guy from California who had a prescription for medical marijuana. He was very ill. The guy had a urinary catheter. I mean, he couldn't even go to the bathroom by himself. He was in so much pain, he couldn't walk to the bathroom. He was using pot for his pain. It was more effective for him than morphine. He had been using morphine before that. Legally, in the state of California. And Alberto Gonzalez decided to throw this guy in jail. So he fled to Canada, and Canada said, sorry, you know, our extradition treaty for the United States says that, you know, if you're being accused of a federal drug crime, we have to send you back. You know, we'd like to keep you here, but we can't. It's the law. This guy gets sent back to the United States with a catheter in handcuffs, thrown into a jail cell with no access to either his pot or his morphine. I mean, this... Now, so that was Friday's story, okay? Here's Monday's story. This is from the BBC. A chemical found in cannabis, otherwise known as pot, can act like an antidepressant, researchers have found. In fact, a team from Canada's University of Saskatchewan suggests the compound causes nerve cells to regenerate. Cannabinoids have been shown to relieve the symptoms of multiple sclerosis and pain relief in humans. They're naturally found in the body as well as being found in the plant, cannabis. The Canadian researchers gave rats injections with high levels of one artificial cannabinoid, HU210, for a month. The animals were seen to have nerve cell regeneration in the hippocampus, which is linked to memory and emotions. The hippocampus is sort of the one-day scratch pad part of the brain. It's where our short-term memory first takes place. In the Canadian study, rats given the cannabinoid were also found to be less anxious and more willing to eat food in new environments, a change which would normally frighten them. Incredible. A Journal of Clinical Investigation study shows rats given a cannabinoid were less anxious and less depressed. Throw them in jail. You know, John Ashcroft's big accomplishment. He put Tommy Chong in jail, right, for selling bongs. Well, that's one smokable substance. Here's another. The U.S. Supreme Court today. Here's John Roberts. I mean, he's the Chief Justice. He has a big say in setting the agenda for the court. Of course, he was a multi-million dollar a year corporate lawyer. And here comes one of the biggest corporate bunches in the country, the tobacco industry. They had been sued. The court that sued them had told, you know, the judge had told them that they had to pay $280 billion out of their profits. Yes, they have profits that exceed that. They had to pay $280 billion out of their profits in a racketeering case, because for decades, for generations, they've been lying to us about the dangers of tobacco. An appeals court, two nominees, two Republican nominees, one Democratic nominee. The importance of stacking the courts, huh? The Republicans get this. An appeals court by a 2-1 vote ruled in February. They don't have to pay the $280 billion. The law, the racketeering law, only allows for forward-looking remedies designed to prevent future violations. You don't think a penalty will prevent a future violation? I mean, that's the whole point of putting people in jail. You say, hey, somebody broke into somebody's house, we're going to put them in jail so they'll learn from it and they won't do it again. Well, you can't put a corporation in jail, so you say, hey, we're going to hit them with a $280 billion fine so they'll learn from it and not doing it again. Well, sorry, says the appeals court, that doesn't work. This went to the Supreme Court, and today, John Roberts in the Supreme Court said, we're not going to take this case. We're going to let the appeals court ruling stand that the tobacco companies don't have to pay this fine. After all, they're just big corporations. They're persons, don't you know? Just like you and me. They're persons. Speaking of wealth, Washington Post, great article today by Robert Samuelson talking about huge increases in home values making people feel richer and spending more of their regular income than they might. Why? Well, in the 90s, it was because the stock market was going up. It didn't affect as many people. Now it's because home values have been going up. People are borrowing against their homes and spending that money. This may be coming to a screeching halt. Turns out last year, 2004, $600 billion was spent over and above ordinary income. This is money people took out of their houses. And the economy depended heavily on all this extra cash. Where's it going to go as mortgage rates go up? Remember, just in 1982, not that long ago, a lot of younger listeners don't remember 82. 1982, the average home mortgage was 15%. Right now, they're just creeping up into the 6% range. So as that rate goes up, we're going to see that the fading suggests Robert Samuelson of America's Wealth Effect. And he says adverse forces are now converging: higher energy prices, higher interest rates and debt payments, higher inflation, falling wealth gains. For two decades, he says, free-spending American consumers have anchored the U.S. and world economies. If they no longer play that role, it's an open and worrisome question. Who will? Well, I can tell you the banks have gotten ready for this. They've changed the bankruptcy laws, so you are stuck forever, you and me, if we get in a bind, if we get in a pinch, if we get caught. If the value of your house collapses and you have that mortgage, you can't get out from underneath it anymore. They timed this just perfectly. It's like, you know, we saw this thing coming. And in the meantime, this from the Wall Street Journal, a bill to boost U.S. pension agency meets resistance by business. Pressure's intensifying to overhaul the federal pension insurance system. But why will it probably not pass? Well, because the business community, particularly General Motors, are trying to kill the legislation because it would force them to fully fund their pension plans. God forbid they should have to fully fund their pension plans. 47 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Thank you, Jackson Brown. 9:50 on the West Coast. What would it be? 12:50 on the East Coast. 50 minutes past the hour all across the United States, all across the world. 50 minutes, 9.5 minutes coming up on the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where being progressive never felt so good. And now, yes, time for our Berlusconi alert for the day. You will recall Silvio Berlusconi, small-time crook in Italy. And entrepreneur, small-time businessman. And he bought a radio station, and then he bought a television station, and then he bought another radio station, and then another television station, and then a newspaper, and then another newspaper, and then a radio network, and then a television network, and then another radio network. And pretty soon he owned all the radio networks and all the TV networks in Italy. And then he ran for president. Well, prime minister, actually. It was his party that ran, to get technical about it, because they have a parliamentary system. But nonetheless, guess who won? Silvio Berlusconi. What a surprise. When you own all the media, you can kind of do that sort of thing. Well, in today's news, this is from the Financial Times. The Italians are starting to get a little fed up with him, but he's pulled a Tom DeLay. It's not quite redistricting. It's a little more subtle than that. We don't need to get into all the details, but here's the summary. Silvio Berlusconi's loudest critic in Italy's ruling center-right coalition resigned at the weekend, giving the prime minister a boost in his bid for re-election next April. In a startling coup last week, Mr. Berlusconi and his allies crushed the center-left opposition in parliament and passed changes to Italy's electoral system. They changed the way people vote that experts say will enhance his prospects of victory in next year's national election. Our Berlusconi alert for the day. Yes, indeed. It's all about Silvio and nothing else. I mean, it's really, really not much of anything else. It's tragically all about Silvio. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. And Bob in Clifton, Tennessee on the line. Hey, Bob, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today? Bob, you got a... Bob is apparently not there. Let's try Tony in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Tony. We're not hearing Tony either. Zach, you got to pot these guys up. Tony in Portland. I'll put him on hold, too, and you guys can figure out there what's going on with your system before we try and take any other phone calls. U.S. and China finance leaders are meeting. U.S. officials said they would press Beijing to move faster on easing controls on the yuan. Now, this seems like, you know, one of those kind of didactic what's going on weird stories, right? What's going on with the yuan? This is the Chinese currency. and the government saying it's undervalued by 40%. Here's how it works. Used to be in the United States, the way that we built a great industrial infrastructure in the United States over a period of 200 plus years is we said, you know, there are some things that we want to import into this country because we simply don't make them here. If you want sandalwood, you can't grow it in the United States. If you want to buy something made out of sandalwood, it's got to come from India pretty much. Or Thailand. You know, if you want curries, you know, the list goes on. You want French wines, you got to get them from France. There are certain things that we don't make here. On the other hand, there are certain things that we do make here, and we would like to protect those industries. We make steel, we make cars, we make ball bearings, we make electronic parts, we make clothing, we make shoes, we make shirts, we make pants, we make sweaters. A lot of things that we made here in the United States, and the way that we protected those domestic industries for 200 years, because all during that time, there were other countries that would have made those things for a whole lot less money. The way that we protected those domestic industries, very simple and very straightforward, was by saying, if it costs, let's take shoes for example, because we don't make shoes in the United States anymore either. If there's a dollar's worth of labor in a pair of shoes made here in the United States, and you can make that same pair of shoes with 10 cents worth of labor in Malaysia, we said, okay, that's fine. You can make those shoes in Malaysia for 10 cents. But when you bring them into the United States, you have to pay a 90-cent tax. It's called a tariff. So it's going to cost you a buck for the labor in the shoes, no matter what. And most manufacturers said, hey, under those circumstances, I'll make them here in the United States. And that's how we kept all these thousands of industries in the United States, is we had what are called tariff laws, tariffs, to protect domestic industries. Well, the Chinese, by the way, still have tariffs. For example, Washington wants China to end foreign ownership caps on financial institutions. Now, if China says, hey, you want to own a bank in China? Sorry, you can't do it. You know, in other words, they're protecting their domestic industries. We don't anymore. We started taking these things apart under Reagan. George Herbert Walker Bush sped it up, you know, seeking fast-track authority. Bill Clinton kicked the door open with his whole DLC, New Democrat, GATT, NAFTA, World Trade Organization thing. And now George W. Bush, the Labor Department, actually telling companies how they can outsource labor. So anyhow, so our government is now saying, well, the problem we have with China is that their currency is too cheap. If they would just increase the value of their currency, it would make imports into the United States of everything more expensive. And you would see a decrease in imports, and that would help our trade balance. There is a certain logic to that. The problem is they'd have to massively increase the value of their currency. And it ain't going to happen. And the second problem with that is it doesn't selectively protect those industries that are necessary. We can't build a missile in the United States. We can't build anything in the United States anymore. Our army uniforms we're not building in the United States. I mean, there's just so much stuff that's not being done right, not being done well in this country because we've exported it, because we did away with the tariff system and replaced it with these multilateral trade agreements, WTO, GATT, NAFTA, and all this stuff. We need to simply say no to these trade agreements, walk away from organizations like NAFTA and WTO, say, that's it, forget it, we're going to go back and do it the way we did for over 200 years in the United States and protect American labor, protect domestic industries, and let the Chinese, you know, take care of China rather than taking care of us. Step one, 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Hey, And welcome back, my friends, to our program. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to Pennsylvania, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on White Rose Society, RadioPower.org, and AirAmericaRadio.com, as well as CRN Digital. Welcome back to our program. C. Conn and Elizabeth Minnick have written a brilliant book, The Fox in the Hen House, How Privatization Threatens Democracy. And C. Conn is with us. Welcome, C.
Tom, I am proud to be on your show. It's good to hear you.
Well, thank you.
It's good to hear you over the phone. I hear you over the radio, but this is a much better way to get acquainted.
Okay. Well, yeah, you've written a great book, and
thank
it's
you.
Absolutely marvelous. One small correction I'd make. You say that in 1886 in Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad, the court ruled that corporations are persons. If you actually read the case, the court did not rule that. In fact, at the end of the case, at the end of the actual case itself, the court ruled that it did not decide the constitutional issue. The headnote says that, and the headnote has no legal standing.
Hopefully, Tom, there will be a second edition. We can make the correction and credit you for it.
Okay. I wrote an entire book about it. It's called Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. So it's my that's my bugaboo. But anyhow, and in fact, this whole structure of corporations being persons is built on a lie. And that's one of the biggest lies, is that ruling happened. And a lot of people are just kind of accepting it, and it didn't happen, actually. But in any case, your book is The Fox in the Hen House, How Privatization Threatens Democracy. Talks about broadly speaking, how if we take public services particularly that have to do with the commons, you know, I don't think any of us are advocating that government should be making our shoes or making our computers or, you know, those kinds of things. This is not none of us are essentially Marxists. But if you take things that have to do with life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, to quote the founders, the commons, the public functions, and you begin to privatize them, or you begin to just destroy government function of them, you create an opportunity for profit that is just turned into an incredible honeypot for big multinational corporations under this administration.
Tom, this is exactly what Cy Conn and Elizabeth Minnick are arguing in The Fox and the Hen House. We're saying, don't think of privatization as business can do it cheaper, business can do it more efficiently. These are the arguments we hear. This is not what this is about. This is the second American Revolution. It is a revolution by the corporations who are trying to upset the balance of powers that has served this country reasonably well for 200 years. It's an attempt by the corporations to take over elements of government and to destroy what they cannot control. We're talking about government by, of, and for the corporation.
And in fact, early on in the book, you have tactics for privatization. And I thought this was a brilliant summary of what we've actually been seeing largely since Ronald Reagan came into office and declared that government, you know, he said that the 9 or 12 or 13, whatever, most dangerous words, scariest words in the human vocabulary are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. And then another one of his punchlines that he tried to work into most of his speeches was that there may be a few good people left in government, but most of them have left because it pays better in the private sector. And as if to say that the only reason why anybody would devote themselves to public services is for a paycheck. And this dismantling of democracy. Give us a summary of the techniques that are used to prepare the American public to accept privatization.
Absolutely. And Tom, you've written about this wonderfully. For example, your recent article right after Hurricane Katrina that says, you can't govern if you don't believe in government, which includes these quotes, lays this out as well. Here's what you do. Let's say you and I, you know, Cy Conn, Tom Hartman, Elizabeth Minnick, my co-author, and the Fox in the Hen House, also my partner and spouse, let's say we decide, you know what, we're on the wrong side. Let's get with the privatizers. Let's make some serious money for once. Here's what you do. The first thing you do is you adopt as your motto, if it ain't broke, break it. So you deliberately go out to damage, undermine, discredit every public service, every government agency. We saw this most dramatically in the last 6 weeks. This is part of what you were writing about in the response to Hurricane Katrina and the deliberate dismantling of FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Administration, in the years leading up to Hurricane Katrina, so that when the hurricane struck, FEMA was completely disabled. there were something like 500 jobs out of a total of 2,500 that were deliberately left vacant. And so the agency did not have leadership. It had a political crony running it. It had vacancies. Professional employees had been replaced by career Republican loyalists. And as a result, there was a total failure, and the lesson becomes, see, government can't do anything right. I don't know if you saw the cover of Fortune magazine on October 3rd. The headline was, Government Broken Down, Business Stepped Up, How Walmart, FedEx, and Home Depot Got the Job Done After Katrina. But that's deliberate. So first, you break down the government. Then you use things like the Fortune headline to say, see, government can't do anything right. And you glorify the private sector. You glorify the corporate executives. How you do this in the face of the Ken Lays of the world is another question. And then you start saying, well, you know what we need to do? We need to allow competition, the free market, you know, that wonderful word free, that wonderful word market. It kind of makes everybody go, let's give the free market a chance to do the job right. So what happens is people respond emotionally because of their own fears. And part of what we're seeing here, of course, is this administration deliberately playing on and worsening the fears that people have, fears of loss of their jobs, loss of their homes. They're saying, you know, if things go on like this, it's all over for you. Let's let business step in. So what we're seeing here by privatizing is quite possibly the largest redistribution of wealth in our country's history, but it's a distribution from the rest of us, from that 95% of Americans who have to get up every day and go to work or their one paycheck around disaster. We are distributing our wealth to these mega corporations, which are larger than most of the countries in the world, and most of us don't even see what's going on.
Yeah, this privatization orgy, and this is absolutely one of the greatest dangers to democracy in the United States. Prisons, for example, you write about prisons at some length in your book, the privatization of the prison industry and the consequences of that. Tell us about that, Cy Conn. We're talking with Cy Conn. He's the author of The Fox and the Hen House, How Privatization Threatens Democracy, or the co-author. And by the way, Cy, is there a website that folks can learn more about?
Yeah, thefoxandthehenhouse.com.
Okay, thefoxandthehenhouse.com.
We're building it. We're getting columns. We're getting articles. We would love the permission to post some of your articles on that.
Feel free. Yeah, absolutely.
Great. All right. Sure. And I should say that I've spent the last half dozen years working with grassroots leadership, a nonprofit organization in Charlotte, North Carolina, that works to abolish for-profit private prisons, jails, and detention centers. Now, Tom, most people don't know that there are prisons for profit. They have no idea that you and I, for example, we could say, you know what? We could make us some money. Let's go out in a cornfield someplace in North Carolina. We can build a prison without permission from any governing authority.
Oh, it's one of the major growth industries in the United States right now.
Absolutely.
In
and
fact,
it's completely unregulated.
Yeah, it's one of the largest construction-based growth industries in the United States.
Right. And what it results in is a lack of protection for public safety, which is critically important, and human tragedy at an unprecedented level. I remember talking with a woman whose nephew, who was a Hawaiian, was in a private prison in Arizona because it was easier for the corporation to imprison this young man in Arizona than in Hawaii, and his mother sold her house to buy an air ticket to come visit him. Now, that's unnecessary roughness. If that was football, that would be 15 yards and more. We have, in this country, a system of checks and balances that sometimes works and sometimes doesn't, but you have to have it there. When you have private prisons, when you have the wholesale turnover of our public lands, our wilderness areas, our hospitals, our roads, and frankly, our military, our protective services, as we have in Iraq today, when you turn those over to the corporations and you say, let's get government off of our backs, what we're saying is, you know what, fellas, let's just take the referees off the field and let's just let the teams go at it. And
what right. Happens? Well, really what you're saying when you say get government off our backs is let's let the corporations get on our backs, because
exactly.
You're going to create a power vacuum. If we the people are going to surrender authority and power and sovereignty, we're surrendering it to somebody, and that somebody is the multinational corporations. Cy Conn, we have less than a minute left, about a half a minute left. The private prison industry is working to generate more business?
Well, of course. Prisons are motels and hotels with bars on the windows. It's all about beds and food service. And so they lobby aggressively and actively to get as many people in prison as possible. This threatens all of our children and grandchildren.
And so we're seeing them lobbying for example, longer sentences for things like pot possession?
Well, they, of course, claim that they don't do this. But, in fact, through the American Legislative Exchange Council, which you're very familiar with, they are deeply influential in terms of legislation.
Yeah, and this is just the tip of the iceberg.
It's just the tip of the iceberg. And, you know, I mean, I'm a loyal American. I believe in the promise of this country, but I believe this country belongs to the people. And I do. And privatization is a tool for transferring wealth and power from the people to the corporations, and we've got to stand against it and stop it.
Yeah, and I would toss in there that I'm not sure if you cover this in the book, but I think the ultimate crime of privatization is the privatization of our vote. 80% of our vote now being privatized by, or being counted in secret by private corporations claiming trade secrecy laws. And that's a pretty big sin as well. So we've been talking with Cy Kahn, along with Elizabeth Minnick, the author and co-author of The Fox in the Hen House, How Privatization Threatens Democracy, the website The Fox in the Hen House. And Cy, great book, good work. Really appreciate what you're doing.
Tom, the feeling is absolutely mutual. You've been there for all of us. Thank you.
Thank you. Good having you with us. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where progressives plot fiendishly for total world domination. 17 minutes past the hour.
We ain't going to the top.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
They pledge to leave no child behind, which hasn't happened yet. They filled the halls of government with CEOs and debt. They promised jobs for everyone, on which I wouldn't bet.
Team Bush goes rolling on.
Yes, Team Bush. You can always depend on them. Welcome back, my friends. 21 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our number 1-866-440-THOM, and Victoria Jones is with us with the Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, are you there?
Yes, I certainly am.
Oh, wonderful. Hey, Victoria, what's happening in Washington, D.C. today? Hello? Victoria? Oh, somebody on the other end. Just,
what did they do to me?
Somebody picked up the phone and was talking to you. Now you're back with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey.
So what's going on in Washington, D.C.?
The entire town, it's as though some kind of time travel thing has zapped it. Everybody is suspended in animation, waiting to find out whether Karl Rove and Scooter Libby are going to be indicted.
Oh, really? The collective breath is being held in Washington, D.C.?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Bets are being laid. It's being discussed over lunches. Everything revolves around this. The Harriet Myers nomination, the Social Security reform, what's going to happen with the war next. That, and of course, Congress coming back this week, and former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay, there are those in the Republican Party who are now saying, look, we want to elect a new guy. We can't have him being standing in the wings anymore. We need to get on with our lives. So he's not happy about that.
Yeah, I can imagine. I can imagine.
Yeah.
So, by the way, I'm curious about Bill Frist. I think you've probably heard my theory about what's going on with Bill Frist.
What? Which is what?
Which is that he's the victim of a revenge attack from George W. Bush more than he is an inside trader.
Ooh.
Let me just lay this out for
Ooh.
You because I think there's some legs to this thing. Bill Frist, because you know how the Bush administration handles betrayal. I mean, the first hour of this program, I read a short list of only about a third of the list of good people who left the administration and then had their reputations trashed because they dared to speak out against the administration. Well, Bill Frist was in like Flint with Bush, sort of. I mean, you know, they were never really all that close, but he was at least part of the administration or, you know, friends with the administration. And then he comes out against stem cell research, or in favor of stem cell research, against Bush. And all of a sudden, there's this whispering campaign going on in his district, you know, and in the national press, about how Healthcare Corporation of America, HCA, the company that his father founded, father the multi-billionaire and his brother Thomas runs, how HCA is one of the largest abortion providers in the United States. And
it's very interesting, the whispering campaign, of course, being a trademark of Karl Rove.
Exactly. So Bill Frist at that point, now he's trying to get the Christian right. I mean, they're his only hope if he wants to be president, and he wants to run for president in 2008. They're his only hope. And here it comes out now that his company, his father's company, is a major abortion provider. So I think at that point, in response to that whispering campaign, he called up the guy who runs his blind trust. And he had to know that there was HCA stock in there. He probably didn't know how much it had, no control over it. But, you know, I mean, you know, what the heck, it's there. He calls him up and says, dump all the HCA stock. The guy dumps all the HCA stock a couple of weeks later, so he can now say, hey, I don't own stock in that abortion provider, because
right.
This is becoming political. A couple of weeks later, the stock tanks, and guess what? The Bush administration-controlled Securities Exchange Commission, which decided not to investigate George W. Bush's inside trading with Harkin Oil, even though that was clearly a criminal. I mean, you go back, I mean, the record is so conspicuous, it's incredible what George W. Bush himself did makes what Martha Stewart was alleged to have done, you know, look like nothing. They're not going to investigate George W. Bush, but all of a sudden now they're investigating Bill Frist. And frankly, I think this is Republican payback against a Republican. You know, and I find it very odd that I'm in the position of defending Bill Frist. I mean, the guy is corrupt as the day is long. He's taken $6 million from the healthcare industry over the years. He slipped the thimerosal, you know, thing into the I think it was a military appropriations bill or whatever it was, omnibus spending bill. You know, he's always been there for the healthcare industry in ways that have certainly not advanced the interests of we the people. But nonetheless, I think this is an attempt to screw Bill Frist by a vicious and vindictive George W. Bush and Karl Rove. As much as it is Bill Frist imploding, because I just don't think that you know, the guy's a multimillionaire. I don't think he's going to engage in inside trading to make a couple hundred thousand dollars. I just don't believe it.
So, in fact, this is fascinating. Under your scenario, the drop in the stock price genuinely was a coincidence.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's the worst luck that could have happened to him.
Well, and in fact, here's where it gets even more interesting. The drop in the stock price was probably something that Bill Frist probably didn't know about because he didn't want to. I mean, I really think he didn't want to break the law. But it wasn't that much of a secret. I mean, if Karl Rove, certainly if the guy who controls the FBI and who can tap phones, had tried at all to find out when HCA was going to be coming out with an earnings report that was going to be less than stellar, which is what happened. HCA came out with an earnings report showing that they weren't meeting earnings expectations, and their stock dropped the next day. I mean, that's just the normal thing. So you've got, you know, Rove with his little tentacles out there in the business community figuring, you know, hearing the inside scoop, or maybe even using the apparatus of government to find out that the stock's going to fall. And that's when he starts the whispering campaign that causes Frist to freak out. Now, I realize this is really sounding like a conspiracy theory, but look what they did to Joe Wilson. You know, if you want conspiracy theories.
That is
so
fascinating.
So what do you think? Yeah, well, you know, try it out on a few people and see what happens. I'd love to get some feedback for it. Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank
Victoria
you.
Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, the website. Great to hear from you, Victoria. Thanks so much for being with us today. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
fearlessly exploring the truth of the day. Here's Tom Hartman.
You may be an ambassador to England or France.
Oh, yeah.
You may like to gamble. You might like to dance.
Oh, boogie on.
You may be the heavyweight champion of the world. You may be a socialite with a long string of pearls. But you're going to have to serve somebody.
And welcome back, my friends.
Yes, indeed. You're going to have to serve somebody.
34 and a half minutes, coming up on 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, 1-866-440-THOM, 1-866-440-8466. Our toll-free number, coast to coast. George Bush told Tony Blair, this from The Guardian, shortly before the invasion of Iraq, that he intended to target other countries, notably Saudi Arabia, which he implied plan to acquire weapons of mass destruction. Mr. Bush said he wanted to go beyond Iraq in dealing with WMD proliferation, mentioning in particular Saudi Arabia. Now, suddenly the Saudis are freaking out. Saudi Arabia, Iran, North Korea, Pakistan, according to a note in a telephone conversation between the two men, that's George Bush and Tony Blair, on January 30th, 2003. This is quoted in the new U.S. edition of a new book called Lawless World, America in the Making and Breaking of Global Rules by the British international lawyer Philippe Sands. And what is significant is the mention of Saudi Arabia because, you know, 15 of the 19th September 11 hijackers were Saudis. But the Bush administration has never come out and said, you know, we need to do something about Saudi Arabia. But it turns out, yeah, they were talking about that with Tony Blair. Fascinating stuff, you know, and we'll see how, you know, how this works out, what happens, how long it takes, you know, is it possible? How, you know, can this thing work? What's going to happen? A lot going on here. A lot going on here. Questions today from longtime White House reporter Helen Thomas. This is amazing. I mean, this is worthy of a conservative alert. Yes, indeed, my friends. Helen Thomas is told by Scotty McClellan that she's a terrorist. Because, in effect, Thomas, what does the president mean by total victory? That we will never leave Iraq until we have total victory. What does that mean? McClellan. Free and democratic Iraq in the heart of the Middle East. Because a free and democratic Iraq in the heart of the Middle East will be... Actually, if I want to imitate his voice, it should be more like... Because a free and democratic Iraq in the heart of the Middle East will be a major blow to the ambition. Thomas, if they ask us to leave, then we'll leave? McClellan, I'm trying to respond. A free and democratic Iraq in the heart of the broader Middle East will be a major blow to the ambitions of Al-Qaeda and their terrorist associates. Yeah, right. Keep in mind, it was Saddam Hussein and Iraq that Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden wanted to invade from Saudi Arabia in 1993. And he was stopped by his own government, the Saudi government. They arrested Osama bin Laden. This was after he had succeeded in throwing out the Soviets from Afghanistan, and he went back to Saudi Arabia, and he said, okay, let's take Saddam Hussein out. He's a secularist. We can't have this cancer of secularism in the Middle East. A government that's not ruled by mullahs? Can't have that, said Osama bin Laden. That's Saddam Hussein. He's a threat. He's a menace. We've got to take him out, said Osama bin Laden. And the Saudi government said, I'm sorry, you're not going to start a war with a neighbor, with a country that's on our border. Yes, they're secular. Yes, they let women vote. Yes, they let women drive and have driver's licenses. They let women go to school. They let women go to university. They have women doctors who actually can work and operate on men, and male doctors who can work and operate on women. And it's a secular society, yes. But sorry, Osama, you can't stop them. He says, well, I'm going to do it anyway. And they exiled him to the Sudan. They stripped him of his Saudi citizenship or his Saudi passport and sent him to Sudan. Get him out of the way. So like a spoiled brat, he's jumping up and down. How can I get attention? How can I get attention? I want some attention. Let's try blowing up some things the United States has. That'll get some attention. But I digress. So Scotty McClellan says, a free and democratic Iraq in the heart of the Middle East will be a major blow to the ambitions. Thomas, are they asking, if they ask us to leave, then we'll leave, Mr. McClellan. They want to establish or impose their rule over the broader Middle East. We saw that in the Zawahiri letter that was released earlier this week by the Intelligence Committee. By the way, have you noticed? It's been 2 years since we've heard from Osama. I think he's dead. In fact, I'd say I'm quite sure he's dead. But the Bush administration doesn't want him dead. Because when the enemy is gone, it's like when Hitler committed suicide, the war was over. You can't have the enemy die if you want to have a war forever, if you want to keep your party in power with continual warfare. It doesn't work. So McClellan, well, Helen, the president recognizes they're engaged in a global war on terrorism, and when you're engaged in a war, it's not always pleasant. Certainly last year's Thomas, this has nothing to do. Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. McClellan, well, you have a very different view of the war on terrorism, and I'm sure you're opposed to the broader war on terrorism. Terry Moran jumps in. Hey, on what basis do you say Helen's opposed to the broader war on terrorism? McClellan, well, she certainly expressed her concern about Afghanistan and Iraq and going into those two countries. I think I can go back and pull up her comments over the course of the past couple of years. Moran, Terry Moran, and speak for her, which is odd. McClellan, no, I said she may be, because certainly if you look at her comments over the past couple of years, she's expressed her concerns. Thomas, now Helen Thomas, speaking for herself, she says, I'm opposed to preemptive war, unprovoked preemptive war. Oh, she must be a terrorist. Must be a terrorist. The White House is not going to allow this one. Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. 1-866-441-THOM, our telephone number. Excuse me, 440-THOM, 440-8466. And we've had a little bit of a glitch in our software between here and New York, so I can see that there are calls, but I don't know who you are or where you're calling from. So I'm going to ask you to identify yourself. I think I can put a caller on. Oh, hang on just a second. I got to reestablish the... my ability to do that as well. Here we go. Okay. Oh, we've got a caller on the air. Hey, how you doing?
Tom?
Yes, sir. Who are you and where are you calling from?
Yeah, my name is Malcolm Cumming, calling from just north of Seattle.
Okay, great. Hey, Malcolm. Thanks for calling 1-866-440-8466. What's up?
Sure. You know, you were talking earlier about privatization
yes.
of you know, government services. And another one that we're all having to deal with right now is the... you know, this Medicare prescription drug plan.
Right.
We just got the booklet a couple days ago. My wife is on Medicare.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you have to sign up with an insurance company to get prescription drugs.
Right. This is the beginning of the privatization of Medicare.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're looking at... you know, there's all different premiums, there's different co-insurances, co-pays, deductibles, and it's real hard to see if we'd have any savings at all in being able to purchase, you know, prescription drugs.
Yeah, I know. My mother-in-law is going through this right now. She's on Social Security and Medicare, and my brother-in-law, who lives next door to her and you know, kind of helps her take care of these, she's a very smart lady. I mean, she's just smart as a whip. And she can't figure this stuff out. And so my brother-in-law, who's my age, he's trying to figure it out. He can't figure it out.
Oh, you can't. Not only you look at the all the costs, you know, the premiums and the co-pays and co-insurances and that, but it comes down to which plan has bargained what rates, you know, for a particular, you know, drug.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty mind-boggling. And Malcolm, what it is this is the Republican deconstruction of the New Deal and of the Great Society. They are you know, it is you know, when Rush Limbaugh came out, you know, with his famous statement, here it is, in fact.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
His policies, of course, being unemployment insurance, Social Security, and attempted health care for the nation. It was LBJ who brought us Medicare, but, you know, Roosevelt tried it, Truman tried it. Anti-discrimination laws, unionization. I mean, you know, the right is not, they're not embarrassed about their agenda, Malcolm.
And, you know, I don't see that we're going to. I don't see that we're going to have any savings from this plan. And I'm wondering, why is it going to cost the country so much to run this Medicare plan?
Because
if it doesn't save us anything, and there's money coming out of the general coffers for the country. Where's the money going?
Well, it's going to the drug companies. The deal that they cut with the drug companies was that the pharmaceutical companies could not be negotiated with. In other words, whenever the government buys pharmaceuticals, or whenever you buy pharmaceuticals using Medicare, you have to pay the full retail price. The government cannot negotiate. Now, the Veterans Administration can negotiate. Congress's insurance companies can negotiate. Private insurance companies can negotiate. But Medicare can't. It's a $300 billion profit windfall gift for the pharmaceutical industry, courtesy of Billy Towson and Bill Frist.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you understand the pain I'm feeling today? The button's pushed, there's no running away. No one's safe with the world in a gray. Take a look around you, boy. It's bound to stay before you tell me over and over and over again, my friend. For you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
Maybe we're not. I don't know. We'll see. We were facing some serious challenges here, but I was having this conversation over the weekend. I spoke at the Bioneers Conference down in San Rafael. And, you know, some folks just a couple of people I spoke with just in utter despair. You know, what's going on? I'm sorry. Despair is not an option. Oh, but we're going the same direction Germany did, you know. And the point, Germany and the United States both faced the Great Depression. Both of us. And we both faced, you know, tremendous economic hardship. Theirs actually started a little earlier than the Great Depression because of the Treaty of Versailles and having lost World War I. But nonetheless, we both faced this terrible economic hardship. And Germany chose to revert back to having a king. You know, people say Hitler was a fascist. He wasn't. He was the reinvention of the old Kaisers. He was a king. He was a mad king, in fact. You know, an absolute tyrannical ruler. Mussolini and Franco, they were fascists. Hitler was a mad king. And the Germans went back. And Americans, the United States, we said, no, we would like democracy. And we picked Franklin Roosevelt. And people say, oh, now we're going down the road to Hitler. Yeah, we are. We're in some ways, because George W. Bush, you know, has that mad king mentality. I won't disagree with that. I mean, there it is, you know.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
And, you know, and his general philosophy.
If it feels good, do it. And if you got a problem, blame it on somebody else.
Yeah. Not to be, fair to him, that was taken out of context, the second one. But in any case, the point is that I don't think, frankly, that is going to be the fate of the United States. I think that America, in fact, I know it. You look at the opinion polls. George Bush is down in the 20s and 30s. Americans are rejecting Bush and his policies. We don't want a king in the United States. We want to have civil government. And the reason why Germany flipped the way it did was because they'd only had a few years of democracy to begin with, only about one generation. It was a new thing to them. They'd had kings for 1,000 years. We have not had a king in 230-plus years, and we don't want one, thank you very much. We don't want corporate kings. We don't want political kings. We don't want dynasties in the White House. We would like to have a democracy of, by, and for we the people. I think that democracy is burned into our DNA. It's part of our genetic code as Americans. I really do. And that's what gives me so much hope for this country. I think we just have tremendous potential and a tremendous future here in the United States. You got another caller here. I'm not sure who you are, but welcome to the program. Hey.
Hey. Tony from Portland, Oregon.
Great. Hey, Tony. What's up?
Hey. This is on to you. This is about an hour and a half ago. When you were talking about the Democratic Party moving to the right. And I was just curious to see your comments about the Supreme Court decision over the summer.
Yeah, Tony, I'm sorry. Either you're calling on a bad cell phone or an internet phone, but it's so harsh that I can't understand what you're saying. If I can't, for sure our listeners can't, so I got to drop the call. I did hear you say something about the Democratic Party moving to the right, and that is a big concern of mine. And what we have to be saying to the Democratic politicians, that is the politicians who are members of the Democratic Party, and again, there is no such thing as a Democrat Party, the Democratic Party. What we have to be saying to the members of the Democratic Party is, the majority of Americans, the middle, the great radical middle that we're all a part of, the great radical middle wants to have universal health care. We would like to see Medicare cover everybody in the United States. We don't want it poison-pilled like the Republicans did with this phony drug legislation that semi-privatizes it and hands billions of dollars off to the pharmaceutical industry. We want responsible and responsive government. We want our commons back. We want our nation back. The vast majority of Americans would like to see Medicare for all, a national single-payer health care system. We already have it in place. All you have to do is extend it to everybody. Oh, but that's going to put a bunch of insurance companies out of business. Fine. You know, there's lots of other things they can do. There are all kinds of business opportunities out there. If you believe in the promise of America, a few companies going out of business should not be a big deal. So, number one, Medicare for everybody. Another, we would like the environment to be clean. Forget about this, clean skies, clear skies initiative. George Bush is, postponing the mercury rules for another 15 years. Let's go back to the rules that as Bill Clinton had established them. And right now, start cleaning up power plants. Let's start decentralizing power and start generating power at the community level. There's 30 million homes in China that are using solar power right now. We can do that. In Germany is now sucking up so much. I was talking with John, the founder and president of Real Goods at the Bioneers Conference, and he said that Germany now is offering tax credits to people to put solar collectors on their roof and feed power back into the grid, and the government and the utilities are required to buy it back. It is such an incentive to people that Germany is sucking up like more than half of the world's production of solar panels. It's hard to find them now, and so factories are being built. It's being cranked up. And as it's being cranked up, this is going to create a whole new renaissance in power generation. We can be at the forefront of that. We can be creating a whole new industry for that. And that's where all those people who are unemployed from the old phony health insurance company industries can go work. I mean, there's so much potential here in the United States. But not as long as we allow these corrupt Republicans and these cons and these frankly corrupt Democrats, the Democratic Leadership Council, Democrats, the folks who are in the pockets of the big corporations, to be running things. We just can't have it. Not if we're going to have an America like our founders envisioned and like we envision, as Franklin Roosevelt envisioned, as has been seen by Americans throughout history. Not always practiced, I'll admit, but the ideals of America, we need to return to them. And that's going to require you and me getting active. Now.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Ryan Zinn is with us. I'm going to have to ask the folks in New York, however, to punch him up and put him on the line because my connection to the server just croaked. If you can, there we go. Hey, Ryan's in.
Hello, how you doing?
Hey, great to have you with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ryan is the National Campaign Coordinator for the Organic Consumers Association. And, you know, this may seem to some folks like, you know, much ado about nothing or something, or oh, it's those health food nuts going off on something. But really, this has, This has to do with some really, really large issues. I mean, when my grandmother was born, 1 in 40 women would get breast cancer. When my mother was born, it was around 1 in 30. When my wife was born, it was roughly 1 in 20. When my daughter was born, it was approaching 1 in 8. And just for example, I mean, just as one, we had somebody on from one of the chemical industries the other day, and they were talking about how, you know, well, we're seeing cancer rates drop. Well, it's because smoking is going down. I mean, that's, you know, but broadly, and we've got, you know, chemo and stuff like that. But the bottom line is there's some nasty stuff out there, and a lot of it's in our food. And people who are concerned about that would like to buy food and eat food that is labeled organic. And this is no longer just, you know, Birkenstock and granola eating folks living in Berkeley, California. This is right across the country. This is middle America now. This is normal. And the food industry has undertaken a sneak attack on those of us who may be concerned about what's in our food. Is that a fair description?
Absolutely. I mean, I think what you're seeing now is that, you know, maybe 20 or 30 years ago, organic food was really sort of maybe a niche or a counterculture phenomenon. But now, I mean, millions of Americans are buying organic food on a regular basis. And I think, you know, big major, you know, food corporations like Kraft and General Mills, as well as retailers like Walmart, are looking at this phenomenon and saying, hey, look, we want to get a piece of the pie.
And so what is this sneak attack that has been attempted on organic standards?
Well, basically what we're seeing really right now is sort of a battle between, you know, the organic movement, which is farmers and consumers and, you know, concerned citizens, and, you know, these sort of like big mega corporations that have this organic facade. And what they want to do is to begin to, you know, market organic processed foods, or even just organic foods in general on the cheap. And what they're trying to do right now is erode organic standards even further by allowing an increasing amount of synthetic ingredients within organic foods. And quite simply, what this does is basically erode the standards that we've fought so hard to establish over the years. I think it's really important to realize that another organization called the Consumers Union, they did a poll and they found that, you know, 80% of consumers, you know, don't want any of these synthetic ingredients in anything that's certified organic. But the reality is in a variety of processed foods, there are synthetic ingredients. So what's happening right now is the organic food industry is trying to not only increase the amount of synthetics, but also undermine the process which we decide what is essentially organic, because it's sort of an evolving definition that we're trying to improve. So what they're doing right now is try to include on a sneak attack through Congress that would basically take out the decision-making power away from the National Organic Standards Board, which is sort of a board that represents all people within the organic community, and basically throw it to Congress and the United States Department of Agriculture. And what this does is basically take away the power from ordinary, you know, citizens like you and I, and places it in the hands of lobbyists who basically have more power on Capitol Hill than we do.
Right now, the definition of organic, this is really interesting. I mean, you know, in chemistry, of course, the definition of organic is anything that contains carbon. But what we have come to understand organic to mean is it's not genetically modified. It's not made with synthetic chemicals. It's not irradiated. Is grown to certain standards of purity and in certain ways, you know, positive, earth-friendly, helpful ways. And I realize there's a whole set of standards there. Those standards, in large part, have been put together, have they not, by a board that is comprised mostly of representatives of the, for lack of a better word, the health food industry, the organic food industry?
Exactly. I mean, you've got the input there of organic farmers, consumer groups like the Organic Consumers Association. And so what we're seeing right now is really a move by, you know, the Bush-appointed Department of Agriculture reps they want to basically change the makeup of the National Organic Standards Board, the very people that really sort of begin to make rulings on what we can consider organic. And what they're doing right now is basically nominating people behind closed doors without any public input. And this really, you know, really subverts the notion of direct democracy when it comes to deciding how we're really going to have an organic standard at the national level.
So you're going to end up with a representative from Monsanto on the board?
Exactly. I mean, you're going to have Walmart, Monsanto, and really all the same people that have, you know, could care less about organics but just want to make, you know, some money off of it, deciding what is organic and how we proceed in the future.
So what can be done about this?
Well, right now, I mean, I think what we've seen in the last couple of weeks is something really, you know, unprecedented in terms of even direct democracy in this country around food. I mean, we've had over 250,000 people take action in the last couple of weeks, calling, sending letters. And I think what has happened is that our representatives in the Senate and both in the House have really felt the pressure. So what happened was there was a sneak attack right that I was getting tried to push through the Senate. But because, you know, places like, you know, organic farmers, organic consumers, natural food stores and cooperatives, you know, folks that don't even really buy organics all that often were really enraged, and they began to contact their senator. As a result, there wasn't a senator on the, you know, the planet that wanted to really, you know, support this rider. So what we've seen is that as sort of a compromise to what the Senate has done is basically thrown it over to the House of Representatives, and now they're trying sort of in a last-minute push to attach it to the Agricultural Appropriations Bill. So there's really sort
in
of...
In the House.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a short window of time, and, you know, those folks that would like to get active and contact their representative can visit our website, and there they can send a fax, an email, get information on how to call their representative, as well as some talking points in really simple language so you understand really what's at stake here.
Yeah, and the telephone number for Congress, here's a couple of the main switchboard. And if you don't know who your member of Congress is, and a lot of folks don't, you know, frankly, it's nothing to be ashamed of, although it's something you want to find out as quickly as you can. We all have two senators. Each state has two senators. And then we all have one member of the House of Representatives, whoever represents our local congressional district. And if you call the main switchboard number at 202-225-3121, and simply ask the operator, you know, here's my zip code, who represents me? They will tell you, and then they will connect you with the office of that person. You don't have to know the office phone number of the individual representative. The main number for the switchboard at Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., 202-225-3121. And here's a toll-free number that you might want to write down and you can call. It's 888-855-3588. 888-355-3588, and ask for your member of Congress of the House of Representatives, not your senator now, because this is now in the hands of the House of Representatives. Ask for your member of Congress, and, you know, tell them. Ryan Zinn, national campaign coordinator for the Organic Consumers Association. How should people phrase the comment that they leave with their congressman or congresswoman's office?
I mean, basically what they should tell them is that they should stop the sneak attack rider on organic standards. And so right now we're at, you know, sort of this critical period where they're trying to attach the rider. And the bottom line is, I think, you know, if they would like to take a look at our website, there's a whole bunch of talking points that they can go under. But pretty much what we're seeing right now is that this rider undermines organic integrity. And the rules process shouldn't be thrown to Congress, but should stay within the National Organic Standards Board.
And you don't want the National Organic Standards Board to be diluted.
Absolutely. I mean, I think what we're seeing here is a variety of ways of attack on organic standards. And, you know, I think, you know, we're looking at, you know, this is sort of like the first wave. The second wave is what we're dealing right now.
Wasn't there an attempt last year to make irradiated foods and GMO foods and sludge fertilized, you know, municipal sludge fertilized foods considered organic?
Exactly. I mean, I think what we've seen is year after year, there's been an attempt to erode and degrade organic standards, and this is just sort of a fact of life that we have to deal with. So the idea now is we need to make sure that we really put the pressure on the Bush administration and the Department of Agriculture not to, you know, appoint sort of these political appointees to the National Organic Standards Board and open up the process so it's transparent and accountable to the organic community or anybody that eats essentially at this point.
Tragically, transparent, accountable, democratic, these are not words that are part of the vocabulary of the Republicans who are controlling the House, the Senate, and the White House at the moment. Or for that matter, some of the more conservative Democrats, the DLC Democrats. And we need to be holding these folks accountable. But once again, the telephone number in Congress, 202-225-3588. 888-355-3121 or 888-355-3588. And what's your website, Ryan, for more information?
It's really simple. It's www.organicconsumers.org, and there at the top of the page you'll see a link for the Safeguard Organic Standards, and right there, if you follow that, you'll be able to, you know, stop the sneak attack on organic standards and send a letter to your congressperson today.
Well done. Ryan Zinn, National Campaign Coordinator for the Organic Consumers Association. Ryan, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Good talking
with you. It's 16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
It's the hard national.
Yeah. Stick that in your pipe and smoke it.
Let it treat it.
It's for all my homies in Bruges.
And welcome back. Yeah. And that's what Bush says to us. Tough luck, you know, tough luck. So you don't like it, you know, go live in Norway or something. That's, oh, my. Well, the British... we're hearing about abuse of Iraqi civilians by soldiers, and they sent somebody over to check into this, find out what was going on. He has come to a bad end. This is just another piece of this, and I'm going to get back to that in just a second. This is just another piece of this larger issue of the phony war, basically. Here's Condi Rice on Meet the Press. Condi Rice on Meet the Press.
We had a choice to make. We could decide that the proximate cause was Al-Qaeda and the people who flew those planes into buildings, and therefore
hang on just a second. The proximate cause.
Okay.
We could decide that the proximate cause of the attack on the United States, 9/11. In fact, it wasn't just the proximate cause, unless you happen to be one of those folks who thinks that the Bush administration had something to do with it. I mean, maybe Condi is a conspiracy theorist. I don't know. But, or, you know, a skeptic or a person who thinks that, you know, Bush had something to do with 9/11. But if not, then, you know, I'd say the broad consensus is that bin Laden had something to do with this, that Al-Qaeda had something to do with this. It was, you know, 15 out of the 19 hijackers were Saudis. And they flew these buildings into the, or these airplanes into the buildings. And, boom, you had 9/11. So, she says... We had a choice. We could decide that the proximate cause was Al-Qaeda and bin Laden and go after bin Laden and solve the problem. Now, that's like what Bill Clinton did when he said, okay, I mean, you know, not using his language, but to paraphrase Condi, said, well, the proximate cause of the bombing of the Oklahoma City building or the Oklahoma Federal building was Tim McVeigh. And, you know, right-wing Christian fundamentalists who thought that they could bring about a revolution in the United States and bring about a Christian theocracy by causing the government to overreact against them if they blew up a federal building. That was what Tim McVeigh was all about. He was trying to act out the Turner Diaries, this novel by I believe it was William McDonald, in which, you know, this you know, good right-wing Protestant Christian gun-owning guy blows up a federal building. And the government stomps on the good right-wing white Christians all around the country to the extent that they all rise up against the government, and you have a revolution. And that's what Tim McVeigh thought he was creating. And that's what Osama bin Laden was hoping to create. If he poked us in the eye, if he hit us hard enough, that we would freak out, that we would just, you know, we would go on an orgy of death and destruction in the Middle East, and everybody would rally around behind him. And guess what? That's what's happened. Osama bin Laden, who, as I said, I am convinced is dead, but that's a whole other thing. So here we have Condi Rice saying, we could have decided that the cause of 9/11 was Osama bin Laden, and we could have taken out Osama bin Laden, and we could have taken out the Taliban and said, that's it, we're done with it. And it would have been. And we wouldn't have dead soldiers in Iraq. We wouldn't have the world hating us. We wouldn't have a billion Muslims, 70-80% of a billion Muslims united against us. We wouldn't have the world vilifying us. We wouldn't have lost our civil liberties. We could have brought to justice the people who caused this. But no, George wanted to have a war in Iraq. Because the neocon philosophy, the neocons had this idea that if you're going to have a world, if you're going to have a country that runs on oil, and ever since 1974 when we hit peak oil in the United States, our oil, our domestic oil production has been declining. And even if you bring Anwar online, and even if you drill for oil off the coast of Florida, all of which looks like it's going to happen, we're still in decline. That if you're going to have a nation that is run on oil in a fashion that is absolutely without limit. I mean, in Europe right now, gasoline is selling for $7 a gallon. Here, you know, we complain about $3 a gallon. And is it any wonder why the average European uses 1/7 as much oil as we do? That if you're going to have a country based on oil, the neocons said, then you got to control the oil. You want to control the oil, you have to control the Middle East. And they brought along the evangelical Christians along with them who want to bring back Jesus, who want to bring back, you know, the second coming, and who believe that in order to do that, you've got to have this battle in the plain of Armageddon, you know, 30, 40 miles northeast of Jerusalem, and you've got to create the second temple, which just happens to be where the Dome of the Mosque is standing right now. So a war in the Middle East, in their mind, would be just a fine thing, thank you very much. And it would be tremendously profitable for the arms industry and the Carlyle Group that Poppy Bush is so heavily invested in. And I don't mean to make this entirely cynical about that, but, you know, this is real. And it would be incredibly profitable for the oil industry. And so, the neocons said, hey, you know, let's go after it. Let's reshape the Middle East. Let's take back the Middle East. And that's what Condi said on Meet the Press. We could have just gone after bin Laden, but we decided instead we're going to reshape the Middle East. We're going to completely reinvent the Middle East. And reshaping the Middle East, what has it brought us? Death, destruction, and the hatred of the world. Time for us to reshape our political landscape in America. It's time for us to get politically involved and get ready for the 2006 elections. Take back the House and the Senate. That's what it's time for. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We gave millions to make you president. Here's a chance to pay us back. The inheritance tax makes my fortune feel all funny.
Hey George,
gotta let it lapse so my kids can have more money.
Hey George,
oh, it's the billionaires for Bush. And welcome back, my friends. 34 and a half minutes before the hour, or after the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Don Alexander's with us. Don is
Tom.
Hey, Don. How you doing? Are you there, Don? Don? Hey, somebody's got to pot Don up. Don Alexander is an award-winning Christian author, and hopefully can hear me. Don? I'm going to try flipping you over to the other... other system here. Don, can you hear me now?
Yeah, I'm here, bud.
Okay, bud?
Yeah.
Okay. Don Alexander, an award-winning Christian author, who suggests that there is anti-Christian bias in the media, and you think that the Harriet Myers nomination to the Supreme Court is really highlighting this anti-Christian bias in the media. As a Christian myself, I would be very concerned if I thought that there was anti-Christian bias in the media. I'm not sure that I see it. What am I missing?
Well, I'm just concerned that we, you know, all of us Christians, we have a free voice and we're listened to just as well as any other religion would be listened to. For example, Buddhism or whatever. You know, just that it seems as though when you're out there as a Christian, and I think the Harriet Myers nomination is a great example. People are so quick to say, oh my gosh, look at all the tabloids, evangelical Christian. And it's like, okay, well, I mean, do we know the background of all our other politicians? And are we so concerned? And why such a big concern?
Well, I think you're missing something. You mentioned in your writing Maureen Dowd and Molly Ivins, and their concern about Harriet Myers and her being a member of an evangelical church is apparently, you know, from what I read of what they wrote, is not that she's Christian or that she's evangelical, but that she's a member of a church that is openly political, that involves itself in politics. And that, you know, historically in the United States, we've had, you know, this was the big debate between Jefferson and Madison. Jefferson was concerned that if religious folks took over government, that we might end up with a theocracy. Madison thought, you know, the Americans would never put up with that. That wasn't the problem. But Madison, in 1814, vetoed the first bill to give money, federal money, to a church in Washington, D.C. to care for the poor, because he said that we should never be giving federal money to churches because it would contaminate the purity of the Christian religion. Madison was a Christian. And he was very concerned about contaminating religion. So both of these founders, and most of the founders, felt that there should be this wall of separation, that religion is about religion. My relationship, you know, to my God, my relationship to Jesus Christ, all of that stuff, that's very real. It's mine. It's personal. But when I take an institution that is being funded with the tax dollars of all of us, because it's nonprofit, so we're paying for its fire protection, its police protection, its use of the commons, and start using that to try and manipulate politics, that's breaking the rules. And I think that that's the concern that people have. It's got nothing to do with Christians being stupid or bigoted.
I hear you, but I wonder if it should be such a big deal. That's one of the things that, you know, that why I'm wondering, you know, why other people aren't seeing the media bias.
So give me an example of it.
Well, like I said, I think the Harriet Myers is wonderful in terms of every day the papers are saying, you know, evangelical Christian. Well, I mean, let's hear from her. Let's hear, you know, where she's coming from. Let's find a little bit about the woman before we, you know.
Well, they talked about, you know, they talked about John Kennedy being Catholic at length in the 1960 election, to the point where he had to call a press conference to specifically address it. I mean,
I think that'd be an excellent idea.
You know, I mean, my point is that a person's religion is part of who they are, particularly if they're part of a religion that is, you know, that is aggressively proselytizing, as the Catholics historically have done and as evangelical Protestants do. But beyond that, that certainly shouldn't disqualify anybody. In fact, I think it's Article 6 of the Constitution says there shall be no religious test, period, no religious test for any office, including judicial offices. And I think the thing that has concerned a lot of people is that Bush has essentially said that he has a religious test, that her church is part of the reason why he picked her. And that seems to a lot of us who think that the Constitution is something that should be literally followed to a large extent. I mean, we don't want to bring back slavery, but that a violation of that provision.
I hear you. I don't have trouble finding where the real issue lies. You know, I think a lot of where we're going as America is a question needs to be asked. You know, are we really headed towards one nation under God, or are we actually going to live for ourselves? And I think when you look at some of the media and some of the responses to Harriet Myers, you have to say it's living for ourselves, because I think the concern is overtly towards this person is a Christian. She's going to vote positive on abortion. She's going to do this and that. And she may not. But the thing is that why is it such a big issue?
Well, I think the thing that you're missing is, if I may respectfully say, it's not a question of one nation under God versus one nation not under God. Really, the idea of America is one nation of, by, and for we the people. And what we have in this sacralization of or desacralization of the United States, we have corporations who are aggressively trying to teach our children that the religion they should follow is the religion of consumerism. And that I see as the greatest threat, frankly, to spirituality of all forms in the United States, to the spiritual impulse. And, you know, the kids think that happiness comes from getting stuff. I realize we're kind of changing the subject here a little bit, but I think that that's frankly one of the greatest threats, not just to Christianity, but to American democracy. The fact that if you can convert people from citizens to consumers, you infantilize them. You make them feel, you make them think that they are the center of the world and that their needs are the only thing that count. And on the other hand, if you can raise the idea of citizenship and say, as a citizen, you know, we have obligations, we have responsibilities, we are participants, we're all in this together. That's the Matthew 25 part of Christianity, really, you know, and the Great Commission as well. And it seems to me like, you know, the corporate dominance is fighting that. When George Bush, after 9/11, people said, what should we do? He said, go shopping. I mean, that's that, in my opinion, that dangerous thing. But I don't see any of this as an attack on Christianity. I think that rather than asking ourselves, are we going to be one nation under God, or are we going to be, you know, one nation that rejects God? We need to be asking ourselves, are we going to be, you know, one nation that accepts the citizenship and the rights and obligations of citizenship, or are we not going to have a dialogue about that and become a nation of consumers?
Oh, I hear you, and I hear you on the consumer end. I mean, I would agree on that ridiculous, you know, it would be ridiculous. But if we get down to the, again, like I said in the beginning, the root of the matter, I think is the attention towards, and again with Harriet Myers, it's kind of why all the attention to her Christianity? You know, and the answer is probably the fear of the fact that people are afraid that she'll vote, you know, she'll vote against abortion, she'll vote.
Well, I think that's probably most of it, because her church is outspokenly political, as I said.
Yeah, and you know, and I hear you on those issues, but I don't know, as a personal, in my personal walk with Christ, I'm trying to live in the Spirit, as the Bible says, you know, walk in the Spirit. And of course, God gave us our intellect, but I think there's a dividing line going on in the body of Christ right now with the people who are. And if you look at the churches, you'll see it really strong. You'll see churches that are separating to what I would call an intelligent sort of religiosity, where they're just really preaching, you know, man is awesome, and, you know, we need to, mm-hmm. you know. I recently was on a radio interview, and the man was openly Christian, you know, that was interviewing with me, saying, you know, but he really believed that homosexuals should be married and have their own rights. Well,
right.
You know, you go to Scripture, you know that's not true, you know, so. I really think it's God has always done, you know, said the what is it called, the scripture, you can remind me, Tom, the road is narrow, you can help me on that scripture, I'm trying to...
Sure, the way is broad to death and destruction, and the road is narrow to heaven. I mean, we're both paraphrasing, it's one of Jesus' parables in Matthew, But, you know, without getting into a discussion of, you know, taking this off issue, again, I think the big concern here, If I may say, you know, and just speaking for myself, my concern is that if Harriet Myers was a member of a church that was, say, she was a member of one of the renegade sects of the LDS, and she was in favor of polygamy, and, you know, and her church was aggressively promoting polygamy, don't you think that that would be a legitimate part of discourse in the newspapers?
And that's, you know, that's an excellent point.
And there's a lot of people who think that abortion is, you know, is a really a political issue, not a religious issue, because it's being determined by a political institution, the courts and the legislatures, and therefore, because this church of hers is involved in a political battle or whatever you want to call it, that it's a legitimate thing to discuss. I don't see this as an attack on Christianity, Don. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, I do agree with you on that. It's definitely a legitimate thing to discuss, no doubt about it. I just, you know, with my principles, go back to the Word of God. You know, I'd probably be called what is it called when you're ultra-conservative and you live...
A fundamentalist.
By the Bible. You know, I try to live by the Word of God. You know, as Scripture is saying, you know, all Scripture is inspired. And so I try to live my life on that. And I think that God is saying to our nation, you know, are you going to live for me? Or are you a Christian nation? Are you going to... Live for yourself, as I said in the beginning, you know. But
we're not a Christian nation.
Well, that's the, okay. You say we're not a Christian nation.
No, we are a secular nation.
I say again.
We are a nation of civil laws. The Constitution says there shall be no religious test for any person in any political office. So, you know, that means that we're a nation of Christians and Jews and Muslims and atheists and pagans and the whole bit.
Right.
We have to be. Otherwise, we're a theocracy, Don.
Yeah, and that's the question I have. You know, do we stay a theocracy, or do we consider becoming as you?
Maybe that's where the dividing line is between us. Don, thanks for being with us in this conversation. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem.
45 minutes past the hour.
Tom.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
We
were born before the wind. Also younger than the sun.
Now, there's a beautiful sentiment.
Yeah, the bonnie boat was won as we sail into the mystic.
I remember Ben Franklin titled one of his essays and then later one of his books, Into the Mystery. And I always think of it when I hear Van Morrison singing that song. Welcome back, my friends. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Tom Hartman here with you 9 minutes before the hour on the place where people, where smart people get their news, the True People's Radio. Don Alexander, when he was yelling Tom, Tom at the end there, he wanted me to share with you, and my bad for not having done it at the very beginning. I always try and do that with our guests, that he is the author of a book called Darnia's Quest, D-A-R-N-I-A-S Quest. It's available in bookstores across the country, and the website DarniasQuest.com or CSNBooks.com if you want to learn more about Don Alexander. I thought it was interesting how he kind of, I don't want to say caved in, but, you know, I was expecting to have a real combative argument here with somebody because his press release says, you know, Alexander argues there is a strong anti-Christian bias in popular culture, seen in pop culture, that caricatures Christians as being ignorant and bigoted. And I'm sorry, I just don't see that. You know, I think that there are a few Christians out there, and again, I speaking as a Christian, I'm a little embarrassed by these folks who are running around saying the world's only 6,000 years old and we should ignore science. And, you know, people have been, these folks have been with us forever. They used to think the world was flat. And they create a caricature, but I don't see the media doing that. So, anyway, it was interesting discussion. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Scott in Seattle, Washington on the line. Hey, Scott, welcome to the program. Scott, let me try flipping you over onto the other board here. Can you hear me now, Scott?
Yes.
Hey, what's up?
I just wanted to point out that as a Christian who goes to church every week, that it is also, in addition to a problem of the theory of the government, the fact that there is no monolithic Christian point that can be represented in the media.
That's right. The renegade LDS folks and the original Mormons believe in polygamy, and they call themselves Christians. You know, there's a whole spectrum of you're absolutely right. There's a whole spectrum of Christianity.
Alternatively, the Mormons believe that homosexuals are sinful, while, for example, the United Church of Christ believes that homosexuals are to be freely welcomed into the congregation, that they are, in fact, part of God's people.
Yes, exactly. And well said, Scott. And in fact, I thought the United Church of Christ's advertising campaign that the major networks wouldn't run showing them welcoming a gay couple into the church before the elections was such an important thing and such a brave stand, and I salute them for that. Scott, thanks for pointing that out. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. Roy in Rio Rancho, New Mexico. Hey, Roy, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Tom. I enjoyed the conversation. I thought you were very kind and educational with the fellow. And as a recovering fundamentalist, I really appreciate it.
Well, I'm a recovering fundamentalist myself, so what can I say?
The reason that I called, though, is I just had a conversation with my son this morning that just slapped me right upside the head as far as the big problem with the media. I ask, now my son is 38 years old, chemical engineer, highly educated, a great kid. Anybody be proud of him? And I said, can you imagine the uproar that would have occurred had Clinton had a Gucker or Gannon in his press room?
Right.
My son did not know.
Yeah.
Who Jeff Gannon was. But 5 minutes later, he said, now, you might not have known this, but, you know, a couple nights ago, there was a real bad call in the White Sox game, and they treated it just like the Republicans did. And I said, well, yeah, I know there was a disputed call. Now, this is a guy that doesn't care if they ever throw another pitch, shoot another basket, or throw another touchdown. I could care less about sports. However, that disputed call, what I knew about it because it was involved in the top of the hour newscast for at least 4 or 5 cycles.
Right. Whereas Jeff Gannon never was.
My son didn't know that a gay prostitute was throwing softball questions to the president.
That's right. Because it wasn't reported in the mainstream media by and large, or if it was, it was an instant story that went right away.
I mean, to me, that was just an absolute, here is the absolute perfect example of the distortion. Plus, as I told my son, you need to get out now. You need to search out some. And hey, now I absolutely know that I'm going to continue forwarding all this stuff from Buzz Flashes.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. That well done. Good on you, Roy. Thanks a lot for calling. Jerry in Edwardsville, Illinois. Hey, Jerry, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. I was listening to you earlier, and I started getting more worried because I think we're probably headed for some kind of a hard landing. And I was thinking
economically, you mean?
Yeah, with because you know things are looking darker and darker. And I was thinking FDR got us out by deficit spending. Of course, he had the war too, but that was deficit spending. But I was thinking, you know, the neocons in a way have blocked it. Even if we elect a Democrat, there's nothing we can do. We can't deficit spend anymore.
Well, FDR didn't just deficit spend. He also raised the top marginal tax rate to 96%.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it was rather substantial and generated a fair amount of income that way because there were a lot of people, millionaires and what in today's dollars would be billionaires during the Great Depression. And that, by the way, that top tax marginal tax rate at 90%, he dropped it back down to 90%, that stayed there until Jack Kennedy came into office. And then when Kennedy came in, during the Kennedy-Nixon debates, he said that he was going to cut the taxes, which of course is what all the Republicans quote him as saying now, and he did. He cut it from 90 down to 70%. But what the Republicans miss, and they all say, well, Kennedy cut the taxes, and by cutting the taxes, he increased government revenue, which is true. He cut it from 90% to 70% and increased government revenue. But the reason government revenue went up was not because of the tax cut. It was because he closed all these loopholes that the millionaires and billionaires were using, and that's what he said in the debate. He said, I'm going to close so many loopholes, it's going to make up for this 20% reduction. And he was right. The bottom line is, if you want to cut government revenue, you cut taxes. It's that simple. If you want to increase government revenue, you increase taxes, you know, up within reason. You take it to 100%, obviously it doesn't work, but that's it. Anyhow, thanks for being with us today. We'll see you tomorrow, same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.